We have thought of the common market as the economic foundation on which shall be built a political structure that would be called, in some modern vernacular, a revival of the ancient Roman Empire, or the Holy Empire that we are familiar with throughout history, from the 6th century B.C. through the collapse of Napoleon's realm, and then revival in the last of the present century. Now, in explaining this material, we've had articles in The Plain Truth, we've had a booklet in particular called Who's the Beast? It has been out of print for a little while. Now, in this booklet, Who is the Beast? Armstrong discusses in particular state of affairs in Western Europe from the 6th century, time of Napoleon, and then skips to the time of Mussolini and Hitler, and comments upon the fact that there is coming yet one more historic revival. I'm not going to deal with the question as I did in a study in Pasadena, but in a slightly different fashion. That have transpired in recent days in Europe with the visit of the Pope to Poland and now to Ireland and the United States. That this man should have created such an impact in Eastern Europe is expected, although the communist hierarchy was shocked at the impact that he had after 30 years of communism in Poland. In describing this whole picture from the time of the fall of the Roman Empire, 476 today, Mr. Armstrong normally has described one half of the story. As he told me in a conversation some 2 decades ago, that our story, as we have explained it, based on Daniel 7, Revelation 13, Revelation 17, is really only that part of the story of the Roman world that transpired in Western Europe, with which either the countries of Israel, those who descend from the 10 lost tribes, or the church in the West would be familiar. But as he has said, we have never really explained what was happening in Eastern or Southeastern Europe, the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, the reason I mention this is that when we look at Daniel chapter 2, you have the story in a form that we have really taken little note of. And I think it is advisable to take a look at the implications of Daniel chapter 2. Now, in this second chapter, we are clearly told that Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of the Chaldean or Babylonian Empire, was the head of gold. The Jehovah's Witnesses, of course, have a different view, but we are not concerned with their view. We are concerned with what Daniel clearly told the king. And after the king, Nebuchadnezzar, and his Chaldean Empire, which was centered in the region we now call Iraq, there should arise another kingdom that would be inferior, as silver is inferior to gold. Then there should arise a kingdom of brass, or bronze, and then a kingdom of iron. Now, what we note is that up to this point, the kingdom of iron has only been described as to the nature of the composition. We have pointed out that there was an Eastern and a Western Roman Empire. The Western Roman Empire had the capital at Rome, the Eastern around 331, this is AD, had a capital at Constantinople on a peninsula that anciently was called Byzantium, and hence the empire commonly, after the fall of Rome in the West, was called Byzantium. It was the Eastern Roman Empire, or Byzantium, B-Y-Z-A-N-T-I-U-M, for those of you who are trying to have a correct spelling. Now, we have never explained what it was like to have the two legs of this giant statue continue through time. all the way down to the feet, which were of iron and clay, meaning partly strong and partly brittle, and then 10 toes. Five on each foot, we presume five, because there's nothing indicating this was an abnormal statue. Now, what we take note of that is significant here is that you and I know that the Roman Empire was both Eastern and Western. It came to be so difficult to rule that they in fact had four or two emperors, not uncommonly, at different periods in history, sharing the load. And the country, the realm that is the Iron Kingdom, was a realm divided into two parts working together. As time went on, of course, the parts worked less and less together, but recognized each other in one capacity or another. We have never taken note of this, however, through time. We have said when Rome fell and Justinian restored the Roman Empire in the West, we really didn't tell you what was going on in the East. Now, it is not important, it's past history. What is important is that there was a Roman Empire in the East that did the restoring in the West. And Justinian created a Western Roman Empire, the capital being essentially at Ravenna, not Rome. And this was a separate realm. There was a legate who ruled the area, and was essentially a separate realm in the West, while the Roman Empire in the East continued. Now we could go through history, which I shall a little bit later, but I want to come down to the experience of the Second World War to show you that you probably all have heard but never understood. And our literature has never emphasized the point that we have described. And that is, during the Second World War, we have said that there was Mussolini's restoration of the Roman Empire, and then there was Hitler's Third Reich. And we have a map usually that shows all of Europe under either a black or a red patch, and that was called the Axis. Axis meaning that there were two major capitals, Rome and Berlin, and the fulcrum, of course, was over the Alps, Germany and the Hitler's Third Reich north of the Alps, and the Italian realm was south of it, and it was a kind of Mediterranean empire, including Libya, Albania, and then in East Africa, Italian, Somaliland, Eritrea, and Ethiopia. All you need to do is look at a map for the time. Now, what Americans and British people, what most of you know, is that there were two famous figures who were leaders in their respective countries. Leaders is the proper term because in Germany, there was no emperor, there was only a leader. In Italy, there was both an emperor and a leader of a party, who was a prime minister. Now, those two famous men, who in a sense directed the thinking and the policy of Europe, were Hitler and Mussolini. What we failed to take note of, that is, I think, very important, Hitler and Mussolini did not form one restoration of the Roman Empire. They formed a restoration, but they were always two realms separately governing, cooperating as best they could. It was as simple as looking at the statue. One part of the foot at the bottom of one leg and the other leg had a foot, and part of the bottom of it would have represented the two realms. In other words, if you were to have the statue facing east, you might say that the right foot represented Italy and the left foot represented Germany at the level just before the toes. What we then should note is that there was no such thing as a restoration of one Roman Empire. Since the image that Daniel saw, or Nebuchadnezzar did, and was revealed to Daniel, had two legs, 2 feet, and toes on each of the feet, we would draw the conclusion that, in general, we should expect, through about time, two separate parts of an empire, separately ruled or jointly ruled, as we will see, at the close. Now, this has a very great importance with respect to Europe, because if Hitler formed the Roman Empire called the Third Empire of the German nation, or the Third Roman Empire of the German nation, that's what the Third Reich was, and Mussolini formed the Roman Empire in the Mediterranean world, we actually have a kind of north-south as distinct from east-west, but after all, in the history of Europe, it varies. Normally it's east-west, and sometimes it's been north-south or north and southeast. In any case, you had two separate realms. And the implication of this is that we should look into the future, and we may well expect to find in Europe not a single restoration of the Roman Empire, but a two-part restoration, but unlike any previous one, this one is called Babylon, politically in Revelation 17, economically in Revelation 18, and religiously in Revelation 17 and other places. And it looks to be very clearly under the rule of a single leader. Under the rule of a single leader. But even though a statue may have 10 toes, 5 on each foot, and in a certain sense be separate in their structure, they have singular leadership because the beast is ultimately described as a single person. There won't be a Hitler Mussolini, there won't be an Axis, but there may well be an economic political structure that is in fact made up of two separate units in Europe. Whereas we have always thought of the common market as the only basis, and nations in Western Europe or behind the Iron Curtain being added one at a time, or two or three, to a single Western Roman Empire, I think this evening when we look through the story, we will have to conclude that it is very likely that we should look for a twofold political and economic structure in Europe, each one being a form of restoration of the Roman structure, the Roman political thinking, the tradition of Western Europe, linked ultimately under the leadership of one man, but made up of 10 nations, and if the statue has some meaning, it would be difficult to see them as other than 5 representing the West and 5 representing the East, being the 5 toes on each of the feet, which tells us something about the nature of what may happen to the common market. But let me go back, now that I have told you about this century, I want to go back and show what we do know about the history of human thinking and to what extent Western Europe has, in a sense, a Western orientation and an Eastern orientation, or a Germanic orientation and a Latin orientation. You can have a Western and a Slavic, a Germanic and a Slavic, a Germanic and a Latin, or a French and Austro-German. There are different thought patterns, different cultural traits. The 3 great entities in Europe are Slavic, Germanic, and Latin. And one or another of these make a contribution. Normally, the Slavic has made the least. It has always been subject to the Germanic if it entered into the structure at all, or it was subject to the Latin in southeastern Europe. But we may see the Slavic element playing a more significant role and the Germanic-Latin combination in the West as already in the common market. So I will now go back to our story. The book of Daniel should be seen in terms of Daniel 2, in terms of Daniel 7, and then Revelation 13 and 17, all together, each one perhaps adding a little to the story that is missing elsewhere. Now, when I discuss briefly here the chain of events in history, there are those who normally have never read the booklet, Who is the Beast, or having read it, thought it was interesting, were sure that Mr. Armstrong was right because he wrote it, and decided to think no further about it. So I would beg of you, if this is, you know, how much you want to know about it, to at least listen and get the feel, because the important part is not any one event in history, but the trend and the implications for the present and future, so that we, in a sense, know what we're looking for and do not wait for what does not appear, and that we would be aware of what is likely to occur, since we have, for the first time in history, a Slav Pope, 59 years of age now, say the newspapers, I don't know just when his birthday was, it was recent, and a man who has certainly a significant number of vigorous years to impart the power, the influence of the church in an area that is destined to change the shape of Europe. If we were to go back, we have, as I said, the story of the upper half of this statue laid out, and in Daniel 7 it is the story of four wild animals. Now, in Daniel chapter 2, the picture is simple. You don't have to turn to these if you're familiar with them, because we'll go from one to another. In Daniel chapter 2, you soon note the importance of the two separate legs, and then the feet and the toes. Now, before we interpret the feet and toes, we probably should say that the implication is that the Roman Empire itself was the two legs, with the east and the west. Now, when we look in Daniel chapter 7, we have a beast instead of an image of a man. Now, in Daniel 2, the reason for the image of a man is that we're talking about human government, human thinking. Human government is the image of man. No animals can create government. Human beings do. Now, we read in Revelation 12 that there is a power that gives authority to human beings and sets some up to rule, and ultimately that authority, which is the devil, also is subject to a higher authority, who is God himself, who determines what the devil may or may not be allowed to do. But in Daniel 7, you have here the nature of these human beings described as a vicious beast. Now, this beast has three fundamental characteristics. One, at some time or another, there is a deadly wound administered, though the beast doesn't die, but it is a wound that was so deadly that at least, let's say, one half the creature would seem to have been subject to death, except that out of that head that was wounded, and remember the primary head was Rome, out of the head that was wounded there were 10 horns. And there was an overthrow of 3 of the 10. So we learn from this that there is going to be some kind of series of successive restorations of Rome, 10 in number, of which a religious power symbolized by another horn, we won't go into great detail there this evening, that this horn uproots 3 of them. These have correctly been identified in the book that Mr. Armstrong wrote, as the Heruli, who first established power in Italy in 476. They were overthrown at the behest of the Catholic community that invited the Ostrogoths into the area in 496. And the Ostrogoths were overthrown when the Catholic community linked up with the armies of the Roman Empire of the East and drove the Goths or the Ostrogoths over the Alps and out of Italy. Now the other group were the Vandals, who first went through this part of the world we have just described, then, that's around 410, and went through southern Gaul, throughout Spain, and went into North Africa, and were overthrown about 535. The Heruli, you see, came later, but were overthrown earlier, and then the Vandals were overthrown in North Africa, and the Ostrogoths were overthrown in Italy. Now, the Churches of God Seventh Day, in whose roots the church may be found in the past century or two, have explained this chapter differently. Now, their explanation, in my judgment, is wholly erroneous, because they include one other power that was not overthrown, but was actually absorbed in Italy, the Lombards. There were only three barbarian nations that at any time either made a covenant with the Eastern Roman Empire to establish it in their part of the West, or reinstituted Roman law or Roman coinage. All of these three kingdoms, the Heruli, the Ostrogoths, and the Vandals, were the only ones that, take note, restored the Roman system of law and coinage and commerce and government in the West and were uprooted. Now, there were others who adopted Roman customs without ever attempting to restore the government, like the Visigoths and the Lombards. But in the end, they were not overthrown by a religious power called Rome. They were absorbed into the community, one in Spain, one in Italy. So, the literature that we have published is clearly precise and accurate on this point. If there is any question, the best simple answer that would support the material we have given is the Encyclopedia of World History, a one-volume work written by William Langer. This is available in most libraries. You could look under the subject, Heruli, Ostrogoths, or Vandals. And William Langer, who is probably the dean of American historians, would tell you that no other structure, no other tribe, no other nation in Western Europe ever attempted to restore the Roman Empire as these three did. They may have been absorbed, but they were never uprooted. Now, the reason they were uprooted is they were all non-Catholic. They were Vandals. Now, I would draw attention, I don't mean Vandals, they were Arians, A-R-I-A-N-S, meaning they were followers of the teachings of Dr. Arius, who differed from the followers of those who upheld the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, most people do not know, but I would mention something that I doubt anybody has mentioned publicly before, unless I inadvertently did in a study. The Arians believed, in general, that the crucifixion occurred on a Wednesday and the resurrection occurred on a Saturday. Herbert W. Armstrong was not the first one to understand this. The first to understand it were the 12 apostles and the rest of the 120. That's why the Bible says what it does. And there was knowledge throughout the early centuries such that it was understood. Throughout the world where the Arians were, except in the Roman world where this knowledge was gradually stamped out. Seventh-day Baptists have held this view 2 and 1 century ago and into the present time. I've seen their literature on the subject. We perhaps have a piece of literature that is clearer than anything that had ever been written before. But it is not that unusual for people who have actually studied the Bible, and it is significant. that the A-R-I-A-N-S, or Aryans, we're not talking of Hitler's Aryans, spelled with a Y, which was a racial term, but this is a religious term, that there is a reason why they were uprooted, because they conceived of the Sabbath as we would. They did not fully understand the nature of God. We are not saying that they were members of the Church of God at all, but they preserved this much of the truth, as I have pointed out this evening. Now, when these three barbarian, non-Catholic restorations of government in the West were overthrown, it was finally possible, over the period of 535 to 554, to see the military efforts in North Africa and Italy have the Roman Empire restored in the West, and we say that this was done by General Belisarius and others, and it was Justinian who restored the empire, but Justinian ruled in the East, and a legate ruled in the West of lesser authority, but he ruled over the Western restoration of the Roman Empire and acknowledged as the senior official in the realm, the government in the East. So as we start out in a period of 1,260 years, Revelation 13, from 554 to 1814, we have the picture now where we see clearly that a religious power is dominant in association with the restorations of the Roman system in the West, having uprooted three. Now, this would tend to tell us that since the Roman Catholic Church is essentially a Western power, and the church in the East that later came to be known as the Orthodox Church is an Eastern one, we would automatically recognize that the role of the church should be linked up with the restorations in the West. Whereas in the East, the state dominated the church, in the West, the church tended to dominate the state. That's a general rule of thumb. Now that we have pictured a restoration in the West, Justinian died in 565, and the empire soon disintegrated. It didn't hold up. We have a cessation of the Roman Empire in the West, but a continuity in the East. That is, the Byzantine Empire, which Justinian ruled and his successors, continued to rule throughout the region of Greece, Bulgaria, parts of Yugoslavia, Romania, Asia Minor, Egypt, Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, you know, this vast area of the Eastern Mediterranean. That is until the coming of the Arabs and Islam. And then the empire shriveled little by little. But we note at this point that when we say Justinian restored the empire in the West, we do not deny, we have just merely never emphasized, that the empire continued in the East. That is, we're saying, in a sense, that one foot represents one part of the story, which we are not discussing normally. And the other foot is parallel to the 10 horns of Daniel 7, or the 10 horns of the book of Revelation, chapter 13. And now we will move on. In the succeeding century, the church had the need to safeguard itself against other Aryan tribes, Lombards and the rest, and they cast about for the Frankish people, those who were French and German, living along the Rhine and other rivers, that is, the rivers of France that flow into the Seine, the Germanic people who lived along the Rhine, the Mosel, and other rivers. And this group of people, called the Franks, made up of a number of nations, up and down the Rhine and adjoining river valleys, were converted to Catholicism, unlike the other tribes of Western Europe. And so the Pope encouraged this family to think in terms of the future of Europe and to perhaps plan to carry the umbrella of civilization. It was as late as 800 AD, however, before the plan was brought to fruition. Now that seems quite a long time, but not everything rushes itself in Europe. It was around Christmas Day in 800 AD that Charlemagne was crowned by the Pope, and he became the first emperor in the West that was not a part of the direct sequence of emperors ruling in Byzantium. That's in the East. But Charlemagne recognized that he was a secondary man, that the emperor in the East even had primacy, because after all, he had just been anointed into this office, whereas the emperors at Byzantium in the East were clearly the successors of the old Roman Empire. But the Catholic Church in the West had no control in the East. They only had control in Western Europe. So what we discover here now is something important. The bishop at Rome had no real power over the emperors in Byzantium, but did dominate over the legates in the West after Justinian restored the empire there. When Charlemagne in 800 AD, or AD 800, we prefer to put AD before the number and BC after a number, that's custom, that's the proper form, although we have deviated from that in our literature, he looked upon the Eastern Roman emperors as, you know, the first among these two equals. When the Roman Church did dominate in the West and used the vehicle of the Frankish Restoration, or the Restoration by Charles the Great, or Charlemagne, that's what Charlemagne means. It's a French word that we have anglicized. In German we call him Karl der Große. It means Charles or Karl the Great. Now this man and his successors were dominated in their views by the clergy in the West. But the clergy in the West did not control the empire in the East. The empire disintegrated into three parts that ultimately gave rise to the three modern nation states of Italy, Germany, and France. It was not exactly that to begin with, but there was a drift in this direction to have three dominant powers outside of the Iberian Peninsula, where Spain is, to have three dominant continental powers in the West, Germany, Italy, and France. Or, let's say, your Gallic people, your Italic people, and your Germanic people, that's what it amounted to. The empire didn't hold together and came apart in the 10th century. Now, in 962, a Saxon king in northwest Germany, Otto, was anointed to be the new Roman Empire, emperor in the West. And all during this time, the Eastern Roman Empire continued. But the Roman Catholic Church did not dominate the empire in the East. It only dominated in the West. This is important to know. I'm only saying this so that you understand the implications of this for the future in terms of Eastern Europe, where atheism is the religion of the state. So you grasp the possibilities. This was the first German restoration, because the Franks were looked upon as partly German, partly French. The Germans have, of course, always felt that the true Franks were Germans, and the French have probably felt that the true Franks were French, and that's why they've never solved their border problems throughout history. This is just the way that these nations have functioned. Now, this first restoration of the Roman Empire in Germany proper is called the First Reich in German tradition. It is the third restoration of the Roman Empire since three barbarian tribes were uprooted in their attempts to restore Rome. But it is called by the Germans the First Reich, meaning the First Empire. This is the first German, purely German restoration in the West, and Byzantium functions in the East. It's like the one foot we have taken no note of, but the other foot, Daniel 7, Revelation 13, takes special note of. In 1254, the last German emperor, and there was more than one dynasty during this time, was killed. There was no government running the empire between 1254 and 1273. This is a 19-year period, which Mr. Armstrong has recognized, and this is why he has taken special note of what was about to happen. This is the time when the heart of Europe, or the Roman world, as it was then in the Holy Roman Empire, was governed by what is called the fist law. The fist law, because every man was a law unto himself, and he whose fist was stronger was the one who got his way. And it was chaos. In 1273, though there were some variations immediately afterward, the general sequence was that the family of the Habsburgs should now rule over the empire. This was a family that came out of Switzerland from a palace or a fort, shall we say, that was named after Hawks, H-A-W-K-S. The German word, that is the English word Habsburg, comes from, ultimately, a root which means Habichtsburg, or the Fort of Hawks, named after Hawks in the area. And the family got its name after the castle in Switzerland, and this family dominated over the region of Austria and Austrian Czechoslovakia, was finally sequentially made a series of emperors throughout time of the Holy Roman Empire, that is, of the German nation. Now we have named the restoration of Justinian and his legates in the West. We have named the Frankish Restoration the First German Reich, and then the continuity of that First German Reich, because it was never politically, it was never militarily destroyed, but it was now run by the Austrians. And the reason they chose a family to do it, instead of electing first one dynasty and then another, is they thought it would give continuity to the empire. So now we are beginning the fourth restoration of Roman government in the West. In this case, by the Habsburgs ruling out of Austria-Hungary, that area, or more properly in that day, Austria, Czechoslovakia, because Hungary was really not of any consequence until the last century in this political sequence. Now, this continued while the Roman Empire in the East was gradually being hammered to pieces. And the Roman Empire in the East, while the Austrians ruled the empire in the West, went side by side until the Eastern Roman Empire finally collapsed and disappeared in 1453. Now there was, of course, a later marriage with the Russian royal family, and the Russians have taken the name of Caesar, but the Russians never, listen carefully, the Russians never viewed the Russian Empire as a Roman Empire, but a Russian Empire that had become acculturated by the Eastern Roman Empire. They never thought of themselves as a restoration of the Roman Empire, but the royal family thought of themselves as descendants of the rulers who once did rule in Byzantium through intermarriage. Therefore, although there was, let us say, a religious and cultural heritage, the Russian system has always and essentially been Russian. But with the collapse of the Roman Empire in the East in the middle of the 15th century, in the West, you note that this was about the time of the high point of the Habsburg family. And in the West, a new pattern was developing in which the emperors were elected over the German Empire, but also ruled vast hereditary territories surrounding the Roman German Empire. That is, as the empire in the East, the story of the feet, or in this case, one of the feet, was disintegrating, the Western pattern was, in a sense, duplicating, so that there was a Holy Roman Empire of the German nation where the Habsburgs were elected with each generation. And around that area, in Austria, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, the Balkans, the lowlands in Spain, and finally the New World, the emperors, one way or another, were linked to other royal families or had hereditary territory that they were ruling. So that these emperors, in a sense, after the middle of the 15th century, not only were ruling the empire, but were creating, if you please, a family hereditary territory in the heart of Europe that we ultimately will find bearing the name of Austria. Now I should like to take note of the implication, because Austria is a word in English that goes back to a Latin word. The German word for this is Österreich, which means the Eastern Reich. And Austria became prominent when Byzantium collapsed. So we have the interesting situation of the Habsburgs being elected to rule over Germany in the last half of the First German Reich, in the Austrian restoration of the Roman government, and finally developing massive hereditary territories that in a sense become an Eastern Reich in the heart of Europe, separated from the German Reich. So that after the Habsburgs dominate during the period of Charles V, 520 and on, you come to the revolutionary period of the 18th century, when France was in ferment and Germany was deteriorating as a result of the terrible 30 years religious wars that destroyed the heartland of Germany between 1618 and 1648. France thereafter became more and more important, and so about 1804, Napoleon, who was a general, came out of Corsica, who descended from the ancient emperors who ruled the Eastern Roman Empire. He was not a Frenchman. He was a descendant of the ancient emperors who ruled the Eastern Roman Empire. He became the emperor in France. And the purpose of having this title was to restore the Roman Empire by the French nation. And the Austrians, at this point in time, accepted that instead of Austria being dominant over Germany, Austria should play a secondary role to France. That is, the French man now, this Napoleon, who was not really a Frenchman, although the French think he is the greatest Frenchman who ever lived, greater even than de Gaulle. The British have always thought he was a cockerel on a dunghill. But different people have different opinions of their great leaders. This man was now a man who dominated over France and Germany and linked the Rhineland states and the other German states to his realm, so that he became, in a sense, the emperor in the area that was now France and Germany, and the Habsburgs continued to rule what was called the Eastern Empire, because Austria, as you see, became more and more prominent as a separate entity in the heart of Europe after the fall of ancient Byzantium. So if you were to look at one... Although the Catholic Church did play, and want to play, a dominant role, it didn't last long. Napoleon crowned himself, took the crown from the Pope, in fact captured the Pope and made him a prisoner in the process of doing this. And in a sense, the Catholic Church really never dominated significantly this French Restoration, but they did dominate the Austrians as they had been throughout the history of the Habsburg family. Napoleon was overthrown in 1814, sent to the Mediterranean island of Elba, came back in 1815 in the famous 100 days in which he attempted to restore the Roman Empire and met with the overwhelming defeat at Waterloo, and was exiled to the South Atlantic. Now, it was an overwhelming defeat, only in this sense, that it could have been an overwhelming victory, and it was a question of who was going to win the day. It could have been an overwhelming defeat for the British, if the Prussian army that had not been involved had not arrived at the last minute, or it could have been an overwhelming defeat for the French, as it then turned out to be when the Allied armies came just in time. Now, 1815, this 100-day period, but the actual empire was never restored. It was only an attempt militarily to do so, and it failed. So from 554 to 1814, Mr. Armstrong has pointed up, are 1,260 years, which is the story of the 42 months, prophetically spoken of, prophetically speaking, written in the book of Revelation, chapter 13. Now you will want to note in chapter 13 that there is one beast which had the characteristics of the lion, the bear, the leopard, and this other creature with its iron teeth. And that one beast in Revelation 13 is really the story of the state of affairs of Daniel 7 as seen in the days of the Roman Empire when the book was written. John is not going back to the previous beast. He's seeing a beast that has in one way or another absorbed the characteristics of all that had gone before, and that beast had 7 heads and 10 horns. Now we note that those 7 heads do seem to parallel the 7 heads of Daniel's beasts in Daniel chapter 7. Babylon was an animal with 1 head. Persia, there was the 2. There was the bear, I should say. And then you have Greece with 4, and then you have Rome. You have an interesting situation whether the number of heads in Daniel 7 and the number of horns are the same. The number of heads and the number of horns, 7 heads, 10 horns, are the same as 7 heads, 10 horns in Daniel, but John sees it in one animal. Daniel saw it in 4. But after all, Daniel sees it before any of the 4 have ceased to be. In fact, before any existed but the first one. He lived into the time of the second one, of course, the Persians. But John in Revelation sees it after Babylon and the Persians and the Greeks had already disappeared from the scene. So, in a sense, John's beast is picking up the story of the Roman world and its succeeding restorations. These 10 corresponding to the 10 horns of Daniel 7. And the 42 months that this system rules in the West represent the period from 554 to 1814. At which point, 5 restorations in the West have now fallen. The restoration under the legates in the days of Justinian, the restoration of Charlemagne and successors, the restoration by Otto, the first German restoration, you see, and then the Austrian Restoration, then the Napoleonic Restoration. These are five restorations. Five are fallen. I say that because when you turn to the book of Revelation chapter 17, you read about a beast with seven heads and ten horns, and you discover that although that's future as John saw it, the whole thing is future, yet when you approach the day of the Lord, John is told that five are fallen. So that the five did survive at some time, but finally, they're past as we approach the closing two centuries of Earth's history. Now, what you note, interestingly, and this is probably the very special contribution Mr. Armstrong made to an understanding of Revelation 17, and that is, Daniel pictures ten horns, of which three were uprooted, leaving only seven. John, in Revelation 13, mentions the same ten horns. He doesn't discuss the matter of the three that were uprooted because that's already the case, and Daniel has already explained it. But Mr. Armstrong perceived correctly that the seven heads in Revelation do not correspond to the seven heads in Daniel 7. Let me correct my statement, or clarify. The seven heads in Revelation 17 do not correspond to the seven heads in Daniel or the seven heads in Revelation 13. But those seven heads represent the last seven horns of Daniel 7 and Revelation 13. You should make note of this important and significant matter, because Mr. Armstrong, therefore, is pointing up that after, let us say, the first three horns were uprooted, you have four, five, six, seven, eight, the next horns, four through eight, five horns altogether, over which the woman would dominate in Daniel 7 or Revelation 13. But these correspond to the first five heads of Revelation 17. And this is all a part of the foot. We haven't gotten to the toes yet of Daniel 2. Now, five are fallen. Now we are told that there is a time where there is one that is and one that is yet to come. That would mean that there are ultimately seven in all over which the woman reigns, because Revelation 17 is telling us of the restorations over which the woman reigns. And there are seven heads. But in Revelation 17, you have the most remarkable statement. There are seven kings, or seven kingdoms, verse 10, five of whom have fallen, and one is, and the other has not yet come. And that continues a brief period. Now, as for the beast, that is this last restoration, that was and is not and shall appear. Now, there are other explanations one can offer, but this is very important to note. It is, in reality, an eighth restoration, but in actuality, it is still one of the seven that John has previously seen. Now, this unique explanation, which is nothing but confusion for most people in verse 11, is very important in terms of the last century and the beginning of the present one. Because the Austrian Empire continued. Napoleon's realm ceased. The Western Restoration of the Roman system ended in 1814. But the Eastern one continued under the Habsburgs, the Eastern Empire, Österreich, Austria. And in 1870-71, there was a Franco-Prussian War, carefully and cleverly instigated by Prince Bismarck, that put on the throne, for the first time in Western Europe, a Protestant emperor who claimed to restore the Roman Empire, and he called it the Second German Reich. Hitler's was the third. This Second German Reich that was restored in 1871 was run, of course, by the Prussians and came to its end in 1918. It came to its end in 1918 at the end of the First World War. Now, this was a restoration of the Roman Empire that Daniel never dreamed of, either in chapter 2 or chapter 7, that John didn't understand because it wasn't pictured in Revelation 13. In fact, it isn't even pictured in Revelation 17, but in the words of Jesus Christ to John via the angel, John might have guessed that if the last restoration is an eighth, then somewhere after the fifth, there would be a restoration of the Roman Empire over which, upon which the woman did not ride. And anybody who knows the history of Europe in this century would know that the Bible most certainly would not have overlooked the tragedy of the First World War. And the fact that the German Kaisers or the German emperors looked upon their Prussian Protestant Empire as a restoration, the second German restoration of the Roman Empire, but one over which Rome did not rule. See, one over which Rome did not rule. That's very important. That, in a sense, will make the seventh one really an eighth, and it will make the sixth one actually a seventh in sequence. But since it was not sat upon by the woman, it is never pictured in any of these prophecies except by the words of Revelation 17:11. But we should note that it does exist, and that the angel knew it would exist, who conveys the message to John. And therefore, we must understand why the First German Reich is described, and the Second German Reich is described, before we come to Hitler. So what we have is a restoration not otherwise defined by Protestants, over which the Roman Catholic Church did not rule. It was in this Protestant Reformation that Bismarck led a Kulturkampf, that is, a cultural struggle against Roman Catholicism. And the battle, let's say, was without definition. The Protestants and Catholics came to terms. Protestants could not win. The Catholics would not lose. And the Catholics did not actually win. And it was a kind of draw within the empire. So in that sense, we now note a restoration, the Second German Reich, we have normally not taken any note of, done by the Kaisers, while the Roman Empire, representing the other foot, was continuing in the person of the Habsburgs that reigned till 1918, when they too were overthrown. So what we have then, by 1918, is the story in the feet, before we come to the leg, before we come to the toes, of a continuity of two basic families, the ancient Byzantium emperors and the Austrian emperors of the Eastern Reich, continuing one part, and these many restorations pictured by the heads in Revelation 17, or the horns in Revelation 13 and Daniel 7. In 1921, a crisis broke out in Italy, and we have a prominent man who became prime minister and who made Victor Emmanuel an emperor, and began to fashion in the late 1920s and 1930s a new restoration of the Roman Empire, which Mr. Armstrong has seen as the one that is. The other one is yet to come. The one that is, when the church became really aware of it, was Mussolini's restoration. But a thing that was very important to take note of here, Mr. Armstrong, even into the Second World War, wondered if Hitler was not, in fact, the Seventh Restoration and Mussolini the Sixth. He wondered about it. You know, after all, Hitler came up in 1933 to power and created the Third German Reich. And it came up after Mussolini, and he wondered, therefore, if one was really following the other. The answer, it turned out to be no. And he was beginning to realize this by 1943. It was very clear that they seemed to be side by side. Well, now, in actuality, one should have expected them, this is hindsight, to be side by side, because all along in history, there have always been two parts to the system. There has always been an empire in the East, whether in Byzantium or in Austria. While there were restorations in Italy and France and Germany and Austria and France, and now at this time, there come to be two restorations again that came to power and became true empires in the 1930s. One north, the other south of the Alps. The Catholic Church never did dominate Hitler's Germany, and many Catholics, of course, were persecuted, as were Jews and Gypsies and Poles and Ukrainians, Slavic peoples of all sorts, and French and Belgians and Dutch, some Danes. It was a terrible time. But what we should have expected, and of course most of the Christian world cared nothing about it, the Church of God had no real understanding, Church of God Seventh Day, and Mr. Armstrong was beginning to get understanding of this picture in the 1930s and 40s. And he came to see, before the war was over, that without any doubt, there were in fact two restorations of the Roman Empire, not one in succession. Not that the church ruled over one and then the other. The church really never dominated other than Italy, and they didn't dominate Germany, because what Hitler created was an amalgam of ancient pagan German rituals. The midnights, fires would often be ignited during the night in amphitheaters, similar to what we have here. They had traditions that went back to the ancient Aryans. They had something from Protestantism and Catholicism, and they linked it together with other things that Hitler came up with, the master race theory. It was a barbarous system, and the Roman Catholic Church did not dominate it. It stepped aside, unfortunately, to let Hitler's empire be created. But they did not dominate it. But they did dominate Italy, having made a concordat in 1929. So it is important to note at this stage that there were two parts to a restoration of the Roman system. The sixth restoration, the one that is, that's the one described here in verse 10 of Revelation 17, and it collapsed in the period of 1944 and 1945. Now, I am emphasizing what is going on so that you understand that through history, the Roman system has never, ever been united since Constantine divided the empire. Never, ever has. There has never been only one restoration. There was no one restoration leading to the First World War. No one restoration leading to the Second. No one leading to the Napoleonic Wars. You had two parts all along. It may have shifted from one area to another. But the Roman Empire has never been able to be a single unit. And in the final analysis, we have, however, something unique. The woman rides the beast in Revelation 17. The final beast, pictured here, has 10 horns. And she's pictured riding the whole system. Of course, they overthrow her finally. Now, these 10 horns in Revelation 17 are not defined as the horns of Revelation 13 or of Daniel 7. In fact, they're not even described at all. These 10 horns of Revelation 17 would correspond to the 10 toes of Daniel chapter 2. Mr. Armstrong did not understand that fully when he first drew it up. He thought maybe the toes represented the successive powers corresponding to the horns of Daniel 7 or Revelation 13. But then he realized that those two chapters really were parallel with the feet of iron and clay, and that the 10 toes really correspond to a 10-fold restoration that will occur only at the close. Only at the close. Hitler attempted to duplicate it, but the final restoration will be 10 powers who will give their power and authority to the beast. They have one mind, verse 13, Revelation 17. And they're going to make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. He's Lord of lords and King of kings. So we now know that this system leads to the coming of Christ. These are 10 kings, verse 12. They have not received royal power because they don't start out as kings. But they are to receive authority as kings for a very brief period called 1 hour in prophecy, together with the beast. And this implies that the beast is a kind of emperor, and these are kings, the emperor being a ruler over kings. So we are probably going to see a shift from a democratic concept, whether east or west. You know, the Russians have democracy too, which is a lie, but that's what they call it. It won't be a democratic system. In either case, it'll ultimately be an authoritarian and a royal system, but not at the start. But if there are 10 horns or 10 kings here, we note, of course, that we do not assume that these are necessarily separate nations, because they may even be blocks of nations. For instance, it would be unthinkable in political power to have Holland and Belgium and Luxembourg have 3 votes and France 1 and Italy 1 and Germany 1. No sensible Frenchman would allow it, no Italian in his right mind, and for the German it is unthinkable. But it may be a block with 1 such vote. That's a possibility. Just bear it in mind, Mr. Armstrong has used the term nations or blocks of nations. But now the implication from this is significant, because we're counting the powers in the common market. There are 9 now, excluding Greece, which is gradually entering. But they're so far behind, there's no telling how long it'll take before there'll really be a 10th, in the true sense of the word. But the Danes would like to get off the bandwagon, and the English are surely going to do it at the most inopportune time and get their nose bloodied for it. And if the Low Countries become 1 block, you have removed, let's say, Denmark, you have removed England in all probability, and you will take 2 votes away in the Low Countries. That's 4. 1, 2, 3, 4 already removed out of the 9, and that leaves you 5. We're just talking, we're not prophesying at this point. But you note that the image that Daniel has in the 2nd chapter has 5 toes on each foot. And the implication politically is that in all probability, the political power in Europe will be developing out of the common market, not as 10, 12, or 13, or 9, But ultimately, the implication of Daniel is that there will be five, let us say, voting powers, if I use a term. It may be more nations, but there will be five powers, five nations and blocks of nations linked together is the implication. Luxembourg is a principality. Both Belgium and Holland are kingdoms. And very likely there could be a linkage there politically, not to become one nation, but to remain separate entities within a higher level called Benelux. In fact, the three do function as one nation economically. Not as Germany or Italy and France, which function as separate nations. These three actually act often as one economic power even now, but not political. Now, the picture that we have then leads us to the question of Eastern Europe. Now, in Eastern Europe, you have what is called the Comecon. In Western Europe, you have the Common Market. The Comecon is the communist common market. These are made up of nations where communism has been entrenched 25 to 30 years. It is made up of Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, East Germany, Romania, Bulgaria. Yugoslavia is not behind the Iron Curtain. It is west of it. Tito saw to the fact that the Iron Curtain was drawn east. Austria is not a part of either the West or the Iron Curtain, but a neutral country. Switzerland, Liechtenstein are neutral. Of course, the Iberian Peninsula is made of people who want to get in. But if I look at the picture, I tend to see the following pattern. I tend to see the possibility that ultimately, if you have the Benelux countries as one power, we may well discover that the German state in the West in some way will be linked up with the East. In any case, East Germany is 95% Protestant and atheist, and only a tiny percentage of Catholic. That is not a Catholic state. It is overwhelmingly a Protestant state. But in the East, Poland is a Protestant, is a Catholic state, excuse the slip of the tongue. Czechoslovakia is primarily a Catholic state. Hungary is significantly a Catholic state. Romania is only a small part one. Now, these are all communist countries. And then, of course, you have the question of the role of East Germany, and then you clearly have the question of the role of Yugoslavia, which is a communist country west of the Iron Curtain. What I perceive is the probability in 1979 and hereafter that the communist parties in Eastern Europe will ultimately be able to retain their political power because there is no true political opposition inside. There's opposition, but they will probably be able to hold their power and as a block. I'm not talking about Bulgaria, which has no Catholics to speak of. As a block, they will most likely link up with the common market, but keeping their separate political entity, it will be what we have always seen. The common market is a capitalist socialist state that will develop with five prominent voting powers, and more nations in all probability, and the Eastern Bloc, or the other part of the restoration of the Roman Empire, will be the Comecon states, essentially retaining a socialist communist form of government that is now entrenched, but in this case linking up with the West, seeing that their cultural heritage is Western. much as Yugoslavia has been, you know, thinking of it, and certainly the Poles are rethinking. This would mean that what we have is a possibility of five nations, there may be more nations, but five voting nations, five powers that determine policy in the Eastern Bloc. That is, each one will demand equal power. Five in the West, five in the East, not six and four, like there are five toes on each foot. We used to picture that there would be only one empire with 10 states, with maybe a Poland coming in on its own, and a Czechoslovakia, and a Hungary, and a Yugoslavia, and it would only be one restoration of the Roman Empire. But there has never been a time that there has only been one restoration of the Roman Empire in the West and nothing in the East. There's always been more than one part of the system. This would indicate that the communist parties will be shifting in the foreseeable future from a position in which they now have. That position is that they have freedom of religion and freedom of anti-religious propaganda. Freedom of religion means that you can make up your own mind religiously after you're 18. Prior to that time, you must be indoctrinated by atheism. And that you cannot, as a parent, indoctrinate your children without coming afoul of the law. Of course, in Poland, this is flouted all the time. The Poles are an independent people, even though the jokes would imply they don't know very much. The Poles are a lot more intelligent than most people give them credit for. One view of the Slav Pope should tell that. There's coming a time when this Slav Pope is going to be able to influence the nations of Eastern Europe. So instead of having only freedom of religion that really means nothing until you're 18, there is not only going to be freedom of religion, but most certainly the church is going to demand and get freedom of religious propaganda as the second step. So there are really three steps. One, freedom of religion in a workable sense, so that parents may teach children. Then freedom of religious propaganda, the right to, in a sense, speak out and convert others, as there will be freedom of anti-religious propaganda. And the final step will undoubtedly be a demand that the Catholic Church be the only officially recognized church in Eastern Europe, as it will make the same demand in the West. The implications then are that we should not expect a unified common market only, on which there will be a political power established called the Beast, but that there will be a part of it that is Western, capitalistic, socialistic oriented, and another part that will ultimately be linked to the West for economic reasons primarily, and ultimately political. It is probable that the political move will in some way be based on the following premise. That if Europe is a kind of neutral zone, it won't be very neutral, but that's what is being spoken of today, in which Western Europe and Eastern Europe will be a part of the Western world, but no longer associated so directly with the United States and the Soviet Union. And a kind of counterbalance against the United States, not necessarily in opposition at first, like China is a counterweight to the Soviet Union. I can foresee, ultimately, this part of Europe coming together, coalescing, making an unexpected deal with Russia so that Europe finally and the Soviet Union come to a secret agreement in which the United States and China are delivered to their mutual neighbors as an inevitable political development. Russia cannot forever allow China to continue, and prophecy implies that Europe will ultimately become very upset at this country and its dollars, and our religious views that keep church and state separate. But when that comes, it will probably be as big a surprise as the Hitler-Russian or von Ribbentrop-Molotov pact in Austin, Moscow in August of 1939, and within a few weeks, by the very beginning of September, the Second World War broke out. It is just such a possible ultimate conclusion. But you see how much must be done along the way. Now, I would point up one other thing, as we have just a few minutes before 9, and I'll take those minutes. In Daniel chapter 11, you note in verse 31 the story of Antiochus Epiphanes coming to the temple area in Palestine in 167, from the period of the spring of 167 to 164 in the autumn. You have a 3.5-year period, a very terrible period. Jesus in Matthew 24 spoke of the time when Jerusalem would be surrounded with armies and an abomination that would make desolate, etc., etc., is there. He says in Matthew 24 to take note, to read what Daniel says about it, and let the reader understand. Now, this man described in verse 31 really comes on the scene in verse 21. And the same person, beginning with verse 21 of Daniel 11, is described all the way through verse 31 and on. Now, his story really ends in verse 31, all the way to the bottom of it. He shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenant. That goes on in 32. And the people who know their God, the Maccabees, ultimately put an end to him. They stand firm and take action. So that in a sense, the story of Antiochus Epiphanes may be thought to end in verse 32. But look at this man. In verse 21, he's described clearly in the place of the predecessor. That's the story of Nicanor and others. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has been given. Now, Hitler was very similar to this, but he was not the ultimate fulfillment. He was a corporal. He was not normal in his mind, demon-possessed on many occasions, satanic-possessed perhaps on rare occasions. A contemptible person. Otto of Habsburg, we've talked about, as a possible leader of Europe. Franz Josef Strauss. I would like to just mention that we should not get locked in to things that we take for granted. The Catholic Church has traditions that there's going to be one more pope after the present one. I personally think the present one is a very important leader, but I do not think that he himself is going to be the final religious leader of Europe. The Catholic traditions would imply one more is yet to come. Their traditions are their own prophecies, but nevertheless, it may well be true. This man is laying the foundation for the link up, in my judgment, of Comic-Con with the common market. To break the division in the heart of Europe, and to create one realm of two parts under a leader. Now, it is quite clear to me that this leader could hardly be somebody from Germany at this stage. I cannot imagine the Italians accepting Strauss. I cannot imagine the French accepting Strauss, and many Germans cannot imagine it. And the Poles would never, never accept it. The Czechs and the Slovaks would have strong misgivings. Strauss is playing a very important role in creating the prominence of Germany, in a sense moving Western Europe in a certain direction. But he is Germany's most brilliant and intelligent and able politician. Even though he may be right just in some of his views, perhaps extreme as others would view him, but it would be very difficult for me or for Mr. Armstrong, who has talked to him as I have, he's been a guest at Mr. Armstrong's home, it would be difficult for Mr. Armstrong to describe that man as contemptible. I would just say that. It would be, in my estimation, unthinkable to describe Otto of Habsburg as contemptible. Both of these men are extremely important in the formation that is going to take place. But this contemptible person, to whom the Royal Majesty has not been given, that is, it was not one of those things you would have thought to have deferred on him, he comes in without warning and obtains the kingdom by flatteries. And suddenly, armies will be utterly swept away before him and broken. We won't go on any further. He acts deceitfully, he just mentioned that, with a small people. And without warning, verse 24, he comes into the richest parts of the province, meaning Palestine at that day in the original fulfillment. But Jesus said the final beast who enters into Palestine is like this person. Now, all that I want to say is that there are three primary figures on the scene creating a new Europe, which, if it were left into the hands of the present politicians, would perhaps be a very stable Europe. But what I perceive is the fact that neither East nor West is likely to agree on somebody who absolutely represents one side or the other. But that there is coming a Pope who will encourage both sides to accept some neutral somewhere in the middle. Austria is in the middle. Austria has the history, you see, of a royal family. This may not be true, I'm just commenting. But I would suspect that somebody who now is not one that would be thought of. You know, Otto of Habsburg is now a German citizen. He's not an Austrian citizen alone as he was. He's a German citizen. And he wanted to do this in order to get in the European Parliament to set the stage and to set policies there over a period of time. I doubt that you and I yet know who the final contemptible man is who comes to prominence without warning, who will be not, let us say, one who will represent either the East or the West, but will be somebody to hold it together along with a religious leader. In order to hold the two parts together, he almost has to be some neutral in the middle. I do not perceive yet that in 1979, October, at the Feast of Tabernacles, that we can be sure that we have pinpointed the name. But we are clear in having pinpointed the office and have a responsibility to Europeans to point out to them the grave consequences if what they are creating should fall into the hands of a contemptible person, someone who doesn't normally merit the dignity that you would attribute to the great political figures of the ten nations, that is the nine in the common market, or any of the figures in Eastern Europe. I think it is wise to keep our judgment open and not to draw hasty conclusions that might be premature, but to watch what the great minds that are now at work are doing. And what they are creating is a system with one terrible flaw. That flaw is the fact that it is government of supreme power that could fall in the hands of a mortal man who will end up not of noble character, but deceptive and contemptible. I don't think we have ever explained it as I have this evening. We are seeing here not only what the church has taught, but what we are adding is what we have perceived all along, that another part of the story is there. And in telling the other half of the story,